This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
It's time for our Monday serial, a respectable veneer written by Rachel Doré, published by Upstart Press and narrated by Romy Hooper. This serial has been made possible by funding from the Earl Creativity and Development Trust with collaboration from Manawatu People's Radio. A Respectable Veneer is a story about love and courage, but we remind you of our regular content warning. There are elements of violence and references to child abuse. Last week, Ruby learned that Frank had told Douglas about her past. Horrified, Douglas tackles Ruby head-on for the truth, and his own trauma from what he'd seen during the war surfaces.
Relishing the quietness, Ruby left Edie to sleep in. Besides, she was enjoying quietly rifling through some of Mrs. Pierce's shoeboxes, full of scraps and notions. She knelt on the floor, a pair of scissors at her side, going through one box after another, without putting things back. Buttons of every size were picked from the bottom of the boxes and lined up on the floor, along with fancy buckles, brass brooch backs and loose beads. Saturday housework could wait. Making a rag doll for Edie out of cream-coloured calico had more appeal. A ball of wool, kinked from its former life as an unpicked jumper, could be the doll's black hair. That reminded her of Angel, whose hair had not been kinked. Angel's hair had cascaded down her back in shining waves, almost blue in the sun, when they used to sit on the summer-warmed back steps at Rat's Nest on Sundays. She dropped the black wool back in the box among other odd ends of yarn and chose a small ball of brown three-ply. The mess she'd made was glorious, oddly luxurious. She looked forward to putting everything back, re-examining it all as she did. A lace collar might be useful. Pieces of buckram might be large enough to stiffen the cuffs of a blouse. There were pieces of fur and an entire skin of a small, soft-furred animal, no bigger than a hand, and short measures of all kinds of lace. Some of them looked ancient. Guipure motifs and decorative panels encrusted with seed beads, which had been salvaged from old garments. "What were you going to do with all this, Mrs. Pierce?" Ruby asked silently. The day Mrs. Pierce left on the train, she had been sure of her future, certain she'd be back working through her hoard of scraps and good intentions, finishing her sewing, making things for the church bazaar. Mrs. Pierce knew she'd be back looking after Frank, listening for his nightmares, ready to soothe him, knowing what to do. Behind Mrs. Pierce's photograph in the sitting room, Ruby had seen the newspaper cutting showing the Laha swollen river and the washed-out bridge that had put an end to it all. Mrs. Pierce had gone off trusting the behemoth to carry her to festivities. Then, in a moment, the carriages in front of hers tipping, falling, tumbling. The alarm and the shock of it had stopped her heart. How long did anyone take to let go of that last breath? When Ruby ventured out with her empty teacup, Frank was nowhere to be seen. From the kitchen window, the day was bright and clear. Silver frost still lay on the lawn. Will-o'-wisps danced their escape from the sunrise, dissolving in the air. On the hob, the half-empty kettle was hot, and two rinsed cups and saucers sat draining on the bench. The teapot had even been emptied. Frank and Douglas only needed one another. She wasn't much use to them, really. Crossing the porch to the lavatory, she saw the washhouse door open and Douglas hauling soaked sheets out of the tub into the washing machine. Poor Frank. If Douglas heard her opening and closing the privy door, he ignored it. Edie sat at the kitchen table with a cardigan over her nightgown, her shoulders hunched with cold. "Just as well I fed that kitten of yours," said Ruby. "I'm not doing it all the time. You have to learn to look after it properly." She heard the edge in her voice and winced. Edie nodded. "And why aren't you dressed?" Ruby turned the hob on under the kettle and opened the packet of Weet-Bix. "Where's Percy now?" Edie shrugged.
"Asleep?"
"It's 9:30. Go and put some warm clothes on." Edie leaned her elbows on the table, her head on her hand. "Go on. It's practically time for morning tea instead of breakfast."
"Where's Uncle Douglas? And Frank?"
"Taking care of their own business, I expect." She put a bowl and spoon on the table.
"Did you see my drawing?"
"No, I didn't. Run and get it and put your clothes on while you're there."
"Frank got Uncle Douglas to pin it on the wall in the dining room. Come and see."
Good use had been made of the things that Madam had given her. The drawing depicted the kitten, curled up with its tail under its nose. Edie had used mauve and blue with the grey pencil, aiming for the kitten's smoky colour. On the top of the paper, in black curly lettering, "I Love Percy," by Edith Henrietta Woods. "It's lovely," said Ruby. Henrietta again. "Woods? Oh, it's really very good. You might have a talent for art." Edie beamed.
"That's what Frank said."
The bare, luminescent innocence of her. Ruby's heart bent under the weight of her love, like a branch strained to breaking point. She had to take Edie in her arms, wishing she knew of a way to love her enough. "Twinkle, twinkle," she said. Edie tipped her head back to see Ruby's face.
"What are you saying twinkle for?"
"That's you, a shiny, twinkly star. I should have called you Stella."
"Stella?"
"It means star."
"It's too late. I'm already Edie. Edith, that'll do."
She slipped out of Ruby's arms.
"I'm getting dressed. We're playing cricket today."
"That'll do," one of Frank's sayings. "Still, it could be worse." "Who's playing cricket? You're not going anywhere."
"Me and Douglas, in the backyard."
"When was this decided?"
"Last night, while I was doing my drawing. They were talking, and I heard Douglas tell Frank he'd get the old cricket bat out of the shed."
Ruby got a glass of water for Edie, her hand shaking. A cricket bat? Not a spade or a rake? Something that could do some actual damage? One of those implements with the long handle and the curved pointy blades at the end? The big one. A nasty weapon, that. Suitable for fending off an intruder. A cricket bat. Oh, how very Douglas. She had half a mind to look in the shed herself. On the other hand, when it came to Lou, choosing a weapon to drive him off would be pointless. It would have to kill him. She imagined herself out there with that lethal-looking gardening tool. She could try to catch his neck with those claw-like tines. Lou would be too quick for that. She put the glass in front of Edie.
"Anyhow, I asked."
Edie sipped the water.
and Uncle Douglas said we were. Cricket was just the ticket, he said.
She cut short a giggle, her eyes on her mother. He did he?
He said he's going to mow a strip in the middle of the yard for us.
Saturday's housework day. It's no use making that face either. You do the hand basin and the taps and go around with the duster. And then you can give me a hand with the washing before I make lunch.
Why do I have to?
Edie whined.
Why can't we leave all that for tomorrow?
Just bloody do as you're told. Douglas appeared in the doorway.
For the love of God, Ruby, leave the kid alone. If she wants to play cricket in the yard, let her. She may want to have a go at using the mower.
Edie slid off her chair.
I'll get dressed. I'm having Weet-Bix for morning tea. Can I have mine split, like Frank does? Like a crunchy sandwich with butter and jam on?
Ease up on her, said Douglas, when Edie had bounced from the room. We none of us know what's going to happen.
He left her standing at the bench. He was right. She watched him from the window, striding past the leafless fruit trees to the shed, each of his steps widening her emptiness. A new fear that she might have lost him took hold. She wasn't letting him get away with it. If she could work out what to say, she'd make him listen to her side. In the passage, she picked up the telephone receiver and dialed a number. Hello, Janice? Would you like to take Edie to a matinee this afternoon? My treat. The sun was heading west. Plenty of afternoon left. When the shadow of the clothesline prop reached the edge of the lemon tree, she'd bring the washing in before the air cooled. Soon after that, Janice would be back with Edie.
Should be dry with that breeze, Frank said from his chair on the porch.
He had a folded blanket over his knees. His hair hadn't been brushed, and he needed a shave. She should talk him into letting Janice cut his hair. If he didn't do something about it soon, he'd start looking like some sort of crank. Yes, she said. Where's Douglas? Douglas had avoided her all day, and she couldn't bear it. Frank blew smoke rings upwards.
If you want Douglas, he was in the sitting room, listening to the radio last time I saw.
She wanted to have it out. Besides, the three of them should talk about what they might do when Lou came back. No use pretending he wouldn't. I might make some biscuits later. She put her hand lightly on Frank's shoulder. Any preferences?
I don't mind. Have we got ginger?
Baking was no use. They should settle things. She went to find Douglas. She found him in the sitting room, buried in the largest armchair. The baritone singing out of the gramophone was in the middle of something doleful, the notes of a soprano winding around, under and over it. A thread of smoke rose from the ashtray. His eyes were closed. The fingers of his hand moved with the music. Ruby took a deep breath, as though she was about to plunge her head under water. Shouldn't we talk?
It's Puccini, he snapped.
He did not move or lift his eyelids. She leaned on the arm of the chair opposite, studying him. He remained immersed in the opera, not facing things. Was he avoiding her out of umbrage and outrage at learning her history from Frank? Did she disgust him now? This last thought was a stone dropped down a dry well, falling past her shame, past the waterline of despair and onto the arid place where an acid rage lurked. How dare he estrange himself from her? To hell with him! Douglas, if you aren't going to talk to me... His hand had stopped waving and he grimaced, the corners of his eyelids creased with his refusal to open them. Forget it! She abandoned the idea of having a talk to find out where she stood with him. His attitude made it plain. I'd like you to go up to the dairy to buy some milk. She raised her voice in a terse command. Buying milk could have waited, but at that moment she was in a mood to inconvenience him. He screwed up his nose like an incredulous kid.
What's that?
2 quarts from the dairy. The bottles are on the bench with the money. The singers faded as he switched the radio off.
What? The dairy? Milk?
He flicked a glance at her.
Why not just put extra bottles out?
We're not putting bottles out tonight. As she left the room, she heard him switch the radio back on. Puccini followed her down the passage. He wouldn't have heard her swearing at him. You'd better go in, Frank, she said, crossing the porch with the empty washing basket. It'll be cold soon. I'll get the fire going in a minute. Frank mumbled a protest and shifted himself. Do you want a hand getting in? She offered. He scowled. The kitten jumped off his lap as he turned back the rug and used his cane to ease himself upright. He was bad again, wasn't he? First thing Monday, she'd phone the doctor to come and give him a shot before he got any worse. Still, playing mother to a pair of grown men who dropped into a funk like a pair of sullen boys rankled. When she made her way through the back door with a basket of dry washing on her hip, Frank sat at the kitchen table, and Douglas, with a jacket and tie on, was putting the quart milk bottles into a leather kit with the air of a recalcitrant schoolboy.
I don't understand why she says we're not putting bottles out, he complained.
Hell's bells, Ruby snorted. He really was the limit. She dumped the basket on the floor. Frank said it for her.
If an unwelcome visitor should call tonight, Douglas dear, a milk bottle might serve him as a weapon. An empty quart bottle could be deadly in the right hands. I mean, the wrong hands.
Douglas's mouth dropped open.
Would he, though?
Frank arched his eyebrows and cocked his chin.
You don't say.
Douglas scratched his head.
Lord.
And Douglas, Ruby said, picking up the basket of washing. While you're at the dairy, see if they'll sell you a loaf of yesterday's bread. I might make bread pudding. Douglas took his hat from the hook.
Righto, he muttered.
She pushed her way past him. She had things to do. You don't say, she mimicked under her breath, halfway up the passage. Bloody ninny. Loneliness ached in her. She looked at her watch. Her watch. 2:30. Edie would be home soon. Folding Edie's clothes seemed the best thing to do. She used the flat of her hand to smooth them, placing them in the drawer as though they were precious. Things that needed ironing could wait. She looked around the lilac room. She had been lucky, hadn't she? The rag doll she had started making was on the shelf where she'd left it, arms splayed, the unfinished back seam gaping open like a gash. She picked up the needle and thread and began with a strong whip stitch, a suture. It soothed her, stitching and pushing and packing the kapok and scrap stuffing firmly into the torso. At last, she held the doll up to face her. Its blank, featureless head lolled forward. She hugged the unclothed, ungiving thing tightly to her chest and felt the beat of her own pulse. They picked at a meal Douglas had cooked. Edie's mood deteriorated. She didn't want to play last card when Frank shuffled the deck. When she accidentally knocked over her mug of milk, she broke into tears and ran to the bedroom, slamming the door. Ruby poked the fire again and put the brass poker back on the stand. It needed a good going over with Brasso. She made a mental note.
"What's up with Tink?" said Frank. "I heard a crash in there."
A crash? She hoped it wasn't the figurine on her night table. Frank's mouth turned down.
"Humph. You haven't told her anything about this chap who's been hounding you, have you?"
"Of course not. She's terrified of him. I don't know what she'd do if she knew."
"Well, our Tink's canny enough to pick up that there's friction in the air. Go easy on her."
In the bedroom, Ruby picked up the pillow Edie had thrown and gathered up the pieces of porcelain. The head had broken off the shepherdess, the neck jagged under the white face with its insipid smile. One white arm was missing, and the blue gown was chipped. Percy the kitten cowered in the corner.
"Look what you've done to Mrs. Pierce's ornament!" She held the pieces she could find in both hands.
"She won't mind."
Edie sat on the bed, hugging her legs.
"She's dead."
Ruby stared at her daughter. What was becoming of her?
"I am very surprised at you, Edie. What will Frank say about this?"
Edie buried her face in her knees. "And Percy's frightened out of his wits." Ruby sat next to her. Frank was right. She was canny, all right.
You've been listening to A Respectable Veneer, a serialized novel by Rachel Doré, read by Romy Hooper. Listen to the next episode at 8 p.m. next Monday, or for the rest of the series, go to npr.nz/show/respectableveneer, or search for A Respectable Veneer wherever you find your podcasts.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.